wanted to start by reading, this is going to be a talk on meaning and motivation. I think the way in which we assign meaning to experience and motivation and sense of purpose and sense of meaning in our life, that is a big issue for some people. And as kind of an introduction to the topic, I wanted to read an article by, a column by Adir Lara, which I saved for 3 years, waiting for an opportunity to read it. And this talk seems to be the opportunity. I'm starting to resent being told to live in the moment. A multitude of books glut the stores, all trying to bully us into applying this Zen insight to our lives. When I hear such advice, I want to say, well, I was going to live in the moment, but now you ruined it by telling me to do so. I myself wrote a book called Slowing Down in a Speeded Up World, filled with hundreds of excellent suggestions from ordinary people for how to do just that, how to notice when you're happy. After I wrote it, I tried following the advice in it. I tried to pay attention to the warmth of the water as I rinse dishes, to the sight of red roses against the blue sky, to the sight of wet clothes billowing on a line. I tried to remember to take my coffee out of the porch in the early morning and enjoy the light. The result was not a more serene Zen like me. The result was a more guilty me. We humans come equipped with imaginations so vivid that our imagined or remembered moments are often precisely what enrich the moment as it is happening. I remember sitting in a beam of sunlight from an open window in a Parisian flat on an August morning last year, waiting for Bill and our friend Frank to come back from returning a rental car, and listening to a Julian Clerc song that I used to listen to when I lived in Paris at the age of 20. I was feeling absolutely happy in that moment, with the sun on my neck and the music and Paris waiting. I was experiencing the moment fully, but the moment was made up partly of the memories evoked by the song and the anticipation of a day walking around Paris with Bill and Frank. What she's pointing to, I think, here in the end is that the part of what enriches our life is a multidimensional life, not just simply a narrow kind of idea of what the present moment is. And that what she found enriching was the sense of her memory that informed that moment of being in Paris and the anticipation of what's going to happen added to the richness of that moment. And if I reread this, but it was a Dharma teacher saying this, it would probably go more like this. We humans come equipped with imagination so vivid that our imagined or remembered moments are often more real than what's actually happening. That's kind of what you expect, right? And what she says is, our imagined or remembered moments are often precisely what enrich the moments as it is happening. I read recently of someone, maybe it was John Cage or someone like him, who went and heard D.T. Suzuki in late 50s in New York City. Someone like him, I don't remember the exact story. But the person went up on the stage, and the first thing the person said was pointed to some, like a painting, a blue painting behind him, and said, what do you see there, to the audience? And people said, oh, I see the sky, I see the ocean. And he said various kinds of things they saw there. And finally the speaker said, does anyone just see blue? And this was kind of a wake-up kind of experience for some people in the audience, because they realized how much they were ready to assign meaning or interpretation on top of what they saw. It was a new idea that you just be present and see something in its rawness, plainly as it was, as it is. But what I find is that some mindfulness students begin thinking that that's all they're supposed to do is to live in a world that's very confined and narrow and limited. It's only about what's happening in the direct moment without any sense of the depth of that present moment, any sense of the past and the future that's part of it, or allowing that part in it as part of it, as it. And part of the depth of practice and depth of present moment is our sense of meaning, the assigning of meaning to experience, and our sense of meaning for our life, the sense of vision we have about what our life is about, that what motivates our life, the sense of purpose we have. And I think, and to a great extent, the teaching of Vipassana can lend itself to the interpretation that assigning meaning to our experience or having a sense of purpose for our life takes us away from the present moment, and it's somehow negated. You shouldn't be involved in that. So I want to talk a little bit about the assigning of meaning first. And I want to tell you, retell you the well-told story of the farmer, the poor farmer who had farmed his farm with a young son, and they had a really decrepit old horse that was a plow horse, barely could pull the plow. And finally the horse died. And the neighbors came over and said, "Oh, this is really terrible. You can barely make a living as it is. Now your horse is dead. How are you going to manage now? This is terrible. It's a disaster for you and your farm." And the old man just said, "We'll see." And then the son went up to the mountains to get firewood, and he found a wild young stallion, really strong horse, and he brought it back, and the neighbor said, "Wow, you're so lucky. Now you'll be able to farm better than ever. You know, tame this horse and you'll be in business." And the old man said, "We'll see." And then as he was trying to tame the horse, the young son was thrown off the horse and broke his leg. And the neighbor said, "Oh, you poor old man, how are you going to manage now? You know, it's a terrible thing that happened to you." And he said, "We'll see." And then the king or the queen declared war in the neighboring kingdom. And recruited all the young men, young women of a fighting age to go off in the war and die. it has to be equal, right? There's a limit. But since the son had broken his leg, you know, he couldn't go off and fight. And so the neighbors came over and said, "Oh, how lucky you are." And the old man said, "We'll see." So, you know, of course, there's no end to the story. But the story speaks to how quickly we assign meaning and significance to anticipated consequences. And I think a lot of the anxiety that people live in our modern lives arises out of anticipated consequences as opposed to real consequences. As if, like someone once said, I had a lot of problems in my life, most of which never happened. We assign meaning, interpretations, significance, value, ideas of consequence, ideas of causality to our direct experience as it's happening. And often they cause us a lot of suffering. And that's why some people then shy away from meaning and interpretation, because of the suffering that often comes with it. One of my favorite, and I've told this many stories, but I like it so much, and you'll forgive me, is of this kind of thinking, inappropriate kind of assigning a meaning, is Sylvia Borstein's story of calling up the San Francisco Zen Center to be a guest. And the office person saying, "Oh, the guest manager, Robert's not in, but he'll call you back." He calls her back, but then Sylvia's not in. So she says, he says, "You know, this is Robert. I'm sorry you're not in, but give me a call." So when she gets home, she calls Zen Center and asks for Robert. And she's told, "Oh, Robert's not in." And so she says, "Oh, I guess this means that I'm not supposed to come to Zen Center." And the office person said, "No, I think it just means Robert's not here." So the assigning of meaning, we tend to be very quick at assigning meaning. And I think it's almost a kind of a biological instinct to do that. The assigning of meaning, of categorizing our experiences and kind of figuring out causality, I think evolutionarily probably makes a lot of sense, even though sometimes it's inaccurate. We have to do that, you know, to survive and get by. You know, you see a track of you're hunting a deer and whatever, and you see the tracks, and you assume, well, that track means that there's a deer up ahead. You know, and so you have to assign some, you know, chances are it's up there, or maybe it's not, but the more often you follow the tracks, you know, as opposed to just wander around randomly, the more often you're going to find the deer. So to categorize our experience and assign meaning and significance and sense of causality to it, I think it's almost an innate biological thing. We kind of, the mind readily does automatically, kind of, it's a meaning-making machine. But it's not always very accurate. And that's where mindfulness practice becomes extremely crucial, is it helps us, one of the very important functions of mindfulness is to help us distinguish what's actually happening versus our interpretations of what's happening, what's actually happening and the meaning we assign to it, so that we can hold the interpretations and meaning lightly. Or maybe if we figure that maybe it's not even valid, we drop it. So we can see the color blue and see, oh, I'm seeing that as if it's an ocean or as if it's the sky. And know that the sky and the ocean is not in the painting, but is the way I want to interpret it. This is a very, very important part of mindfulness. That's why we train ourselves to be very simple with the breath. The breath is such a simple, basic thing. And then we start noticing how we don't leave it so simple. We assign meaning to my tremendous success at staying with my breath. You know, I must be the next Buddha. Or, you know, maybe it's not that way for some of you. Maybe for some of you it's the opposite, you know. I can't follow one breath at all. This is terrible. I'm just, you know, Buddhism wasn't meant for me. It just means that today, you know, you're not staying well with your breath. It doesn't mean anything more than that. But we assign greater meaning, and we suffer often because of that. And one example of how quick we are to categorize and how it's almost an innate part of the brain is when I was in Thailand, I was staying in a little cabin on the beach, and I was taking a nap in the afternoon. And I had a dream. And in the dream, it was somewhat elaborate, but eventually I was walking over a grassy knoll. And I stepped over the crest of the grassy knoll, and as my foot went over the crest, it stepped in the dream onto a spike that was sticking out of the ground. And it, you know, penetrated my foot, and it really hurt. And that was kind of a vivid dream, so I kind of knew I was dreaming in a sense, but it was really painful. So I kind of laid there just, you know, because it was a dream, right? It was really painful. Finally, it was so painful, it woke me up. And then I realized that one of these great Thai ants had bitten my foot. And I was really in a lot of pain. Hard to believe how much pain an ant can cause, but it was really intense. But my brain, being kind of dreaming or doing, you know, not being so present, had to somehow categorize that experience, or wanted to, or intended to do that, or did it. But, you know, it wasn't so present for what was really going on, so it kind of chose something nice, you know, or chose something that made sense, given the dream that I was having, to somehow place that physical experience. Another place we see this is in near-death experiences. In the world over, there's some common experiences some people have in near-death experiences. The seeing of tunnels, seeing of bright lights. And sometimes people at the end of the tunnel or in the bright light or whatever, they'll see a figure. Often it's a religious figure. And what's interesting is in different religious cultures, it's their religious figure of choice. But it's very quick and easy, I think, if we don't know about this common phenomena, to think it's not a function of the brain or the mind to see figures. It's really, you know, Avalokiteshvara or Muhammad or Jesus who's really come to me and saving me or doing something for me in my, you know, or St. Peter, he's really there, you know. He's there ready to welcome me in or give me the SAT or something. You know, I don't know, you know, the veracity of some of these kinds of experiences, but the fact that they are so universal and the figures are so varied depending on the religious that people belong to, I think it's probably a kind of vision that the mind makes. It may be a very significant vision, but we don't want to assign any greater meaning than it is a product of the mind and our conditioning and our hope and our faith. One of the more dramatic examples of this that really gets people's attention is that some years ago, some 10 years ago or so, some psychologists did a study of children in New York City who had near-death experiences. And there was a high incidence of kids having these visions, and they saw the Ninja Turtles. So, what about these experiences? Part of our assigning of meaning to our experience is that it can be self-fulfilling. So if we have assigning a meaning which is kind of a negative meaning, it can be self-fulfilling and kind of pull us down. Or positive meaning can kind of bring us up. In the book Emotional Intelligence by Daniel Goldman, he gives an account of an Olympic swimmer named Biondi in 1988, who looked like very promising. He looked like he might match the number of gold medals that Mark Spitz made. And in the first meet, he lost. Maybe it was third place or something, which is losing in Olympics, right? And he didn't have a very good time. And then the next meet, he lost again. And the sportscaster was saying, "Oh, you know, how is he going to recover from this? You know, he's going to be so kind of down from losing, and he's not really going to get that psychological edge anymore to kind of be able to win any more of the meets." And a psychologist who had studied Biondi knew otherwise, and knew that Biondi was an optimist, and he would learn from his mistakes and feel kind of he would apply himself even more, and that's what happened. He won the next five meets. Five gold medals. And the psychologist had done this test on Biondi and other swimmers. It doesn't seem like a very kind test, but they had set up a meet, a swimming race that seemed very significant, or maybe it was significant. And so the swimmers swam it, a number of these races, and they were going to compare the times and the different races. But at the end of the first race, some of them had very good scores. Biondi had a very good score, very good, what is it called, time. But the researchers, lied to him. They told him his time was much poorer than it actually was, and other swimmers. And in Biondi's case, he made up for that in the next meet. He more than made up for it. He kind of did super well the next time. Whereas some other swimmers, their times dropped even more dramatic, dropped back, because they were more pessimistic frame of mind. So the assigning of meaning, of optimism, pessimism, is not inherent in our experience. It belongs to the world of assigning meaning or anticipated consequences. And hopefully the mindfulness practice helps us to look at how we begin assigning meaning, how we kind of make more optimistic views or pessimistic views that are different from what's actually happening. So are we then to find no meaning in life? And meaning is so problematic, it can cause so much suffering. I think that meaning, purpose, sense of direction, aspiration for something is a very important part of life. The Buddhist word for this is the word vision. The Buddha was motivated by a tremendous sense of vision. Both his vision for freedom, and once he was one of the descriptions of his experience of freedom, was it what has awoken him was a vision, a tremendous vision. Vision implies a sense of purpose or possibility or direction for a person's life. Often, when people teach mindfulness practice, and we do it, teachers will talk about being goalless in practice. Not having any goal beyond the present moment, just to really be here presently. And that might be fine as a strategy for moment-to-moment practice, but that doesn't negate in any sense of the way the possibility of having a larger sense of motivation or purpose or vision for our life, within which that moment-to-moment goalless practice occurs. And I notice that some people in our circles feel very shy sometimes about engaging themselves in questions of the greater meaning of their life or purpose of their life, the vision for their life. Now, motivation, if people don't have some real sense of significance or meaning for their life, it's very easy for their lives to become lethargic, or kind of their energy, their vitality to be drained, or go numb, or become depressive. I think a sense of meaning and purpose is a very important part of life. When I was usually a little bit embarrassed to tell this story, but that's okay. When I finally got my visa to go to Burma, to practice in Burma, I was going to go. It was kind of like I'd been practicing Buddhism for many years, and it was the end of the line for me. I just knew I had to go to Burma to kind of throw myself into the practice for however long it was going to take, whatever that meant. But I had trouble getting a visa to go to Burma because Burma is kind of a closed country. And it took me about 9 months to get the visa. And finally, when I got the visa from the embassy in Bangkok, I held the visa in one hand, my passport from the visa inside, and it was skipping and dancing down the streets of Bangkok, singing the song, "You can get it if you really want, but you gotta try, try and try." And I was really happy, because this tremendous sense of motivation, or sense of purpose, you know, was finally, you know, I could follow through on it. The sense of motivation in life is often highlighted at times of crisis, when people get diagnosed with a terminal illness or have a near-death experience, or someone, some loved person dies. Questions like, what is life? What is death? Who am I? What's the purpose of life? The great spiritual question is, who am I? But I don't know, sometimes I think maybe a better question is, why am I? That's a good question, isn't it? And the strength of that question can come from many sources. Certainly the strength can come from our fear of death, or fear of crisis, fear of loss. It can come from the depth of our grief, from our anger. But it can also come from the contact with what some people might call the mystery of life, the awe of life. You know, we can so easy to live our daily life kind of an automatic pilot without really marveling at the awesomeness of what it means to be alive. You know, it's kind of interesting sometimes to imagine what it'd be like to look through your eyes if you knew you only had a minute left to live. I think you'd look at life very differently through those kinds of eyes. For some people, the sense of motivation and purpose and these deep questions of life can sometimes be highlighted by reflecting on our life over a long period of time. So you reflect back over 20 years. What's happened in 20 years in your life? What's really significant over the last 20 years? As Jack Kornfield likes to point out, at the end of life, people usually don't ask, did I get more raises than anyone else? You know, did I have the nicest car than anyone else? But people ask, did I really love well? Did I really connect with the people that were important for me? Did I ask for forgiveness? Did I express my love? Reflecting over a long period of time sometimes can really highlight what's really important. Some people, it's useful to reflect forward in time. What do I want to happen in the next 20 years of my life? What's really important for me to accomplish if I have 20 years left, if I have 5 years left or 1 year left? What's really important to do? Now, searching for meaning and purpose in our life is fraught with peril, because we can use meaning to prop up our identity, to feel good about ourselves as somebody. Many people feel kind of unworthy or kind of empty or not very kind of fulfilled in themselves. And so they'll look elsewhere to latch onto some other thing that provides them with an identity that of importance. Some people do that with their spouses. Some people will do it with political parties. Or some people do it with ideologies. Some people do it with a particular social group they join. Some people do it with teachers. That teacher is really great. And so as long as I'm close to that teacher, then I'm great too. You know, or this particular, you know, whatever. There's all kinds of ways in which we will borrow our sense of purpose and meaning and significance from the world around us to prop ourselves up. And that's somewhat dangerous to do. The example that I know most close at hand of this, a dramatic example of this was in the 70s in the San Francisco Zen Center. The Zen Center had an abbot who was somewhat charismatic and very bright and very intelligent and had a great sense of vision. and had a tremendous ability to give Dharma talks where you felt that during his talks, that Zen center was at the center of the world. Like everything important in the world, the cutting edge of development, the most happening in the world, all the important movements were somehow being spearheaded at the San Francisco Zen Center. And he knew Governor Brown, who would come over to Zen Center and talk with him regularly, and he was in touch with the embassy in Moscow, and he knew Gregory Bateson, he knew all these really important intellectual people and scientists and politicians. And his, you know, I don't, his Dharma talks would be filled with stories of meeting that person and this project and that project. I don't remember very much Dharma being told. But, you know, you sit there kind of on your edge, you know, waiting for the next installment and feeling, you know, like and being part of Zen Center and contributing to Zen Center is really kind of like the most important thing happening in saving the world. And so, of course, that bubble eventually popped. And when it did, some people felt tremendously betrayed. And some of the personal pain connected to this kind of kind of taking meaning and purpose in their life from someone else, from some being involved with some great movement, really burned people so badly that some people left Buddhism and practice entirely. As an institution, this was one of the best things that ever happened to Zen Center, to have that bubble popped. Because people really then saw the degree to which projection and transference and ideals and borrowing of purpose and meaning from someone else is really a problem in a spiritual life. And so they kind of began looking more deeply at what spirituality really is, what Zen practice really is. Now, this idea of our motivation being self-fulfilling, our sense of meaning being self-fulfilling, I think is a very important one. The more we stand behind or get involved or support a particular motivation in life, a purpose in life, the stronger it becomes in turn. We feed it by our involvement with it. So there's this story. Are we doing okay? I'm not speaking too fast, trying to get through this. You with me? For several weeks, strange sounds had drifted over the mountains from the neighboring valley. There was much talk in the village about what these noises could be, but no one could make sense of them. Even the village elders had never heard anything like them. Finally, one of the young men in the village was chosen to cross the mountains and see what was going on. After 2 days of hiking, he reached the mountaintop and saw in the valley far below him a hive of activity with dozens of people working. As he drew closer, he saw a line of people, each with a huge stone in front of them, that they were hammering and chiseling. When he finally reached the valley floor, he approached a young man at one end of the line and asked, "What are you doing?" "Huh," grunted the young man. "I'm killing time until I get off work." Puzzled, the hiker turned to the second person in the line, a young woman, and asked, "Excuse me, but what are you doing?" "I'm earning a living to support my family," she responded. Scratching his head, the hiker moved on to the third person and asked again, "What are you doing?" "I'm creating a beautiful statue," came the answer. "Ah," said the hiker, "I think I'm beginning to understand." Approaching the woman who was next in line, he asked, "And what are you doing?" "I'm helping the people in this town and the generations that follow them by helping to build this cathedral." "Wonderful," explained the hiker. "And you, sir?" he called to the man beside her. "I'm helping to build this cathedral in order to serve all those who use it and to awaken myself in the process. I am seeking my salvation through service to others." Finally, the hiker turned to the last stone worker, an old, lively person whose eyes twinkled and whose mouth formed a perpetual smile. "And what are you doing?" he inquired. "Me?" smiled the elder. "Doing?" The elder roared with laughter. "This ego dissolved into God many years ago. There's no I left to do anything. God works through this body to help and awaken all people and draw them to him." So 7 people doing the same thing. 7 different understandings of what they're doing. The person who's killing time is going to go home depressed, discouraged, come back reluctantly the next day, is not going to have a good time. The person feeding her family it's a good thing to do, valuable thing to do. Maybe she's inspired from that, but there's no sense that what she's doing or what she's actually doing has value in and of itself. And then you see there's kind of in some sense kind of loftier or greater sense of aspiration and purposes as we go through here. And I suspect that as the sense of aspiration, sense of purpose and value, what they're doing becomes greater than just for themselves, but serving other people, there's probably greater energy and likeness and joy in what they're doing. And then finally, what's interesting is the last one, he says, or she says, me doing. This ego dissolved into God many years ago. There's no I left to do anything. And in a sense, you might say, well, there's no motivation or purpose anymore. This idea of purpose disappears. Intentional activity disappears when we just become empty for the Dharma or God or whatever you want to call it to move through us. But even here, I think, he has the idea there is a greater meaning to what he's doing, because he does say God works through this body to help and awaken all people and draw them to him. He has a sense that his life does fit into a larger sense of meaning, even though he is somehow out of the way. It just feels like he's a channel, perhaps, or a vehicle for that larger reality. One of the dangers is when people hear about the highest ideals of a spiritual tradition, like this man here who says, I'm not doing anything, is they feel that that's the way they should always be, or they're supposed to be there right away. That just not having any sense of purpose, giving up all purpose, just being with the flow, might be fine for someone who's very well developed, but it can be a dead end for people who are not. People do it prematurely before it really is the awakening moving through us, then we can end up killing very important parts of our lives. That part of us which is self-motivated, that does have a sense of personal purpose or value, significance, which is a very important part of life. Well, maybe another way of looking at this is that the sense of purpose and motivation is part of the great width and depth of a human being. And there's many, we're multifaceted. And there's facets of it which are more like these receptacles for the Dharma, and other aspects of us which really have a great sense of purpose and motivation. It's interesting that the character of Zen practice is that is total absorption in what you're doing, kind of attaining oneness with what you're doing. You're chopping vegetables, just you and the vegetables, just you disappear, just the chopping of the vegetable, just you're the vegetable. And the total absorption, or the hot dog kind of joke, right, about Zen, become one with everything is kind of a Zen idea. Now, there's some truth that a very important aspect of Zen is this, complete involvement with the present moment. But Zen, as a tradition, as a practice, as a spiritual tradition, is much wider than that, and not just so limited to that narrow world, just totally be absorbed in that one activity. And you see it especially if you go to Asia, to Japanese Zen monasteries or Chinese Zen monasteries, where when a monk is going to wash their face, they don't just kind of throw themselves into washing the face and becoming one with the water. Before they wash their face in the monastery, they've memorized a four-line poem that they recite. And the four-line poem begins with the words, "For the sake of all beings, I now wash my face." May I wash my face so that all people may see their original face. What do they say at the baths of Tassajara before you go bathing?
I just want to remember removing the dust and forget the whole thing. As I wash.
I don't remember.
Do they remember? So they say it every day when they're there, but they don't remember. At Tassajara, before the monks and the monastics go into the bath to bathe, they say a little.
Remove the dust from body and mind.
Yeah. Washing body and mind. Something. For the sake of all being, washing body and mind. I forget also. It's embarrassing. I said it for years. But I think you get the idea that so you know, before you go in, to the bathroom, when you go to the bathroom, you kind of snap your fingers to warn the spirits underneath there in the outhouse. And then you say this little verse, you know, I may empty myself so that all beings may be empty of greed, hate, and delusion. Or the point being that you place what you're doing in a larger context than only, you know, I'm washing my face or I'm cooking the dishes. You're connecting your life with the lives of others. You're connecting your activity with a larger sense of connection to the wider world. And this is a very important part of Zen practice that we don't hear about in the caricature of it we get here in the West sometimes. The sense of intention and motivation for your life and your purpose and for your life is a very, very important part of Zen practice. And cultivating and developing it through these verses and through reflection happens a lot in Asian Zen monasteries. And again, if we don't really respect our need for, our human need for meaning and motivation and significance, it's all too easy to end up with a sense of meaninglessness or nihilism or cynicism or distrust in life. But again, it's very tricky, this whole idea of motivation. Some people can be phenomenally motivated in practice, but not articulate in any kind of words in what they're doing. Some people will struggle with this question for years, thinking that they're hardly, you know, able to begin their spiritual practice, only to realize years later that was a very powerful practice in its own right, just to be grappling with issues of what's really meaningful, why am I here? Some people find that they'll choose significance and meaning which are dead ends and cause them a lot of suffering. Some people will find that a certain sense of significance and meaning works in a certain period of their life and not in other periods of their life. You might find that the sense of motivation and purpose for life doesn't come from intellectual answers. No matter how many books you read and how many other great thinkers who, you know, are ready to give you the purpose of life, the answer's not going to come from there. Maybe it has to be something that bubbles up inside of you, almost bodily kind of, a physical kind of felt sense of what's really important. In the way that if you're really up against a life crisis, up against your death or terminal illness, where does that deep sense of questioning and wonder and where does that arise out of? It's a wonderful place. It can be a wonderful place. Can you somehow find a way to let the answer inside of you bubble up from some deep place inside of you? And not just kind of think your way into an answer for this. There's this wonderful story. Oh, I want to read this quote by Thomas Merton. True love and prayer is learned in the hour when prayer is impossible and the heart is turned to stone. What do you think of that? True love and prayer is learned in the hour when prayer is impossible and the heart is turned to stone. I don't know if it's always that way, but that's one of the ways. And occasionally when I counsel people, like on retreats, you know, I really want people to suffer less. And I really want to kind of, people come to me sometimes hoping I'd have some wonderful little trick and help them suffer less. And sometimes I can offer some practices or some ideas or some insights that are helpful. But occasionally I meet someone where I feel that I would do them a disservice by offering them anything at all. And that really what they need to do is to suffer more. Occasionally that's the case. Because only by suffering thoroughly, really kind of, will they really kind of face themselves in a really fundamental way, and some other thing will happen, some letting go or some shift or some really getting down to the root of what's really going on. And so as Thomas Merton says, true love and prayer is learned. Well, I like to modify it. One way true love and prayer is learned is in the hour when prayer is impossible and the heart is turned to stone. And some people are afraid to go that far. So where does a sense of purpose and motivation come from? Many years ago, when I worked as a volunteer at Stanford Hospital, I got to know a little girl named Liz who was suffering from a rare and serious disease. Her only chance of recovery appeared to be a blood transfusion from her 5-year-old brother, who had miraculously survived the same disease and had developed the antibodies needed to combat that illness. The doctor explained the situation to her little brother and asked the boy if he'd be willing to give his blood to his sister. I saw him hesitate for only a moment before taking a deep breath and saying, "Yes, I'll do it if it will save Liz." As the transfusion progressed, he lay in the bed next to his sister and smiled, as we all did, seeing the color returning to her cheeks. Then his face grew pale and his smile faded. He looked up at the doctor and asked with a trembling voice, "Will I start to die right away?" Being young, the boy had misunderstood the doctor. He thought he was going to have to give her all his blood. The boy hardly hesitated at all. He thought he was going to die, and he hardly hesitated. That sense of purpose and mission or vision for life, where does that come from? Where does that bubble up out of? When do we feel that kind of connection? I think sometimes people who struggle a lot in life occasionally, what they need is to be pushed out into the world, into some place of great challenge, to go off into the world, in a world which is maybe not so comfortable. Because sometimes living a very comfortable life and then feeling kind of like that's where I have to stay, I can't leave my comfort, is a way of not really allowing the full depth of how we can respond to life and be motivated by our life to really show itself. And we might stay in a comfortable world and do endless amount of spiritual practice or endless amount of psychotherapy, and it simply doesn't allow for the depths of who we are to come up and bubble up and really show ourselves and see. And in the way I think the depths of this little boy showed itself when he was asked, when he thought he was being asked to save his sister through giving up his own life. So I don't know how anyone interprets this talk or what meaning you'll assign to it.
Blue.
Good. But I think I'm trying to make a plug that the idea of sense of finding motivation and significance, purpose, is actually part of the great depth and complexity of who, what our life is. And we don't want to simplistically kind of deny it or avoid it. Even though moment to moment in practice we don't look at it particularly, but we do in the rest of our rich life. And that it's possible to have great vision that really puts us on fire, as it did for the Buddha, for example, his vision for freedom, his vision to come to the root of his suffering and put an end to it. Or the vision of the Buddha or a Bodhisattva to offer their life in service for others, to see the tremendous amount of suffering in the world, and have a vision for the possibility of not having that suffering. In the same way that the famous words of Martin Luther King when he said, "I have a dream." That's a vision, a tremendous vision that kind of galvanized many people in this country. And still, people read it and hear it and are moved by his dream, his vision that he had. I hope that Buddhism doesn't, your contact with Buddhism doesn't in any way discourage you from your capacity to dream and have vision. But I hope that contact with Buddhism helps you to distinguish between interpretation and what's actually happening, vision and what's actually happening, so that your aspiration can fill you with life and you can have less and less expectation. So that you can have aspiration or vision instead of craving and need and expectation. Aspiration should be kind of liberating in itself. Expectation and demand is enslaving. But it's a perilous quest to find motivation and purpose in life, meaning. So at your own risk, I wish you well. So thank you all very much.